we are in the midst of a study of the book of Deuteronomy in our evening worship services, so I invite you to turn to chapter 20 of the book of Deuteronomy as we will be studying this chapter this evening. And just a reminder, we're in the midst of a section of Deuteronomy where it's giving a little bit more of an exposition of the Ten Commandments. This section pretty much tracks with the Ten Commandments, and we're in the part where it's focusing upon the prohibition against murder and all the different facets, or at least some of the different facets of that. Last week, how to deal with somebody who had slayed someone accidentally to make sure that justice was upheld without an overreaction. This week, focusing upon warfare and how it is to be conducted. So listen now to God's holy word, Deuteronomy chapter 20, beginning in verse 1. When you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when you draw near to the battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people, and shall say to them, "Hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you the victory." Then the officers shall speak to the people, saying, "Is there any man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. And is there any man who has planted a vineyard and has not enjoyed its fruit? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man enjoy its fruit. And is there any man who has betrothed a wife and has not taken her? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in battle and another man take her." And the officers shall speak further to the people and say, "Is there any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own." And when the officers have finished speaking to the people, then commanders shall be appointed at the head of the people. When you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. And if it responds to you peaceably and it opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. But if it makes no peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall put all its males to the sword. But the women and the little ones, the livestock, and everything else in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as plunder for yourselves. And you shall enjoy the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not cities of the nations here. But in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall devote them to complete destruction. The Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods, and so you sin against the Lord your God. When you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, You shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. You may eat from them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field human, that they should be besieged by you? Only the trees that you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down, that you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it falls. Thus far the reading of God's holy and inspired word. May he add his blessing to it this night. When we read passages like this, Old Testament passages that speak of the warfare in which Israel engaged as God's holy nation, it can seem difficult to apply it to our own lives. It can seem like there's little for us to learn from such passages. We do live in a very different context. We live at a different time on the redemptive historical timeline. Under the new covenant, the church is not called to wage physical combat against the enemies of God. But what we do need to remember as we think about such passages is that, well, we certainly are still enlisted in the same spiritual battle. And in this battle, our true enemy is not the people of this world. It is instead the demonic power who rules over them and leads them in their rebellion against God. The Apostle Paul famously talks about this in his epistle to the Ephesians in the last chapter of that letter, where he says, "We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places." So as we study this portion of the book of Deuteronomy this evening, we certainly do need to remember that, yes, this was originally addressed to God's people in a particular context that's different than ours. But we can also approach it with the understanding that it does have lessons for us, lessons to teach us about the church's ongoing warfare. Now, I think the chapter divides nicely into two halves. If you look at verses 1 through 9, basically one theme focused upon there, and then verses 10 through 20 focus on another theme. And in the first half of the chapter, the prevailing theme is the importance of maintaining morale among the fighting forces. And the first thing that is addressed along those lines is that the Israelites are not to be afraid, especially when they find themselves going up against superior military forces. Even when their enemies have horses and chariots that they might not have, even when their enemies have a larger army, they are to remember the thing that is most important. And what is that? It is that the Lord is with them. As one commentator puts it, Israel's strength lay not in numbers, not in the superiority of their weapons, but in their God. And God, of course, proved that to his people at the time of the Exodus from Egypt. On their own, in their own might and power, they were absolutely no match for Pharaoh and his army. And yet the Lord triumphed for them. Now here in Deuteronomy 20, the Lord says that he will further assure his people of this by sending a priest along with the army when they go to war. And the priest was to speak these words to the people. "Hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to give you the victory." So the priest's, just his presence with the army was quite significant, because he represented the sanctuary of the Lord. By being there, he consecrated the battle to the Lord and to the advance of his kingdom. And the people should draw great encouragement from his presence and from his words. Now, the principle that's expressed in this opening part of the chapter certainly remains just as true for God's people today. We should not be afraid, even though there are great powers aligned against the church. And they are great. When you start to think about it, it gets pretty unsettling. And yet we always have to remember that the one who is with us is greater than the one who is with the world. He is infinitely greater than the one who is with the world. We don't need to be afraid. When the forces of evil have greater wealth and more cultural and political power than the church has. After all, we aren't fighting the battle with those weapons anyways. We aren't fighting with worldly weapons. As the Apostle Paul reminds us in 2 Corinthians 10, we're not waging war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but they have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God and take every thought captive to obey Christ. Now, there's another thing that's said in the first half of this chapter that really has to do with this basic theme of morale among the troops. And that is that there's a listing of situations that gave a man exemption from combat. And the reason why these exemptions are listed here is to make sure that morale was not in any way harmed by people feeling like they were getting the shaft by being forced to go to war. Unlike other nations, Israel's troops were to serve willingly and not under compulsion. Various exemptions, therefore, were granted out of compassion for a man's situation, making sure that he would not miss out on enjoying the fruits of his labors. Things like building homes or planting vineyards or getting married and having a family. Those things were at the heart of normal life in the Promised Land. And for that reason, it was fitting that those things should, in some sense at least, take priority over the warfare that was needed to secure the land. Now, of course, they still needed troops to go to battle, and so there's not, an unlimited list of exemptions. There's some limitations here, and yet there are exemptions. Now, in addition to that, there's another exemption that's listed, and that is if a man is too afraid, he doesn't have to fight. He's not to be bullied into battle. He's not to be court-martialed for his lack of courage. And we know very well that, fear can spread just as easily as a highly contagious disease. We've seen that happen in the world over the past year. And in an army, fear undermines an army's resolve and commitment. And those who are afraid in that kind of situation, especially if you're fighting in the Lord's army, as the Israelites were, they're lacking in faith. And the battle has to be fought in faith. And so the Lord grants an exemption to such people who just can't muster up the courage, whose faith is too weak to be able to go out to battle. Now, it might seem like granting all of these exemptions would make Israel's army too small. But that's, in some sense, that's just the point. The Lord can save by many or he can save by a few. It doesn't matter. As one writer puts it, the size of the army was less important than the faith of those who composed it. I think that these exemptions do reveal something to us about God's character. They show us that the Lord is compassionate in his dealings with his children. He doesn't ask us to do what is unreasonable. He doesn't ask us to do what's beyond our capacity. And neither does he despise us because of our weakness. He knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust, as the psalmist reminds us. And what a morale booster it is to know that such a God is with us and that he is for us. And when we are aware of that, we can really say, well, then who shall be against us? Well, that brings us then to the second half of the chapter. And here we have rules that are set forth for Israel's conduct of warfare. And in these rules, we get two pictures of the advance of God's kingdom. And the key thing to note in this section is that there is a distinction that is made between two kinds of warfare. There is a distinction between warfare that's conducted outside the borders of Canaan and warfare that is conducted inside the borders of Canaan. Meredith Klein introduces this section this way. He says, while all Israelite military operations sanctioned by the Lord were theocratic judgments, and the adversary always assumed the character of enemy of God's kingdom, a distinction was made between wars waged against the Canaanite nations and against nations very far off. So yes, any enemy that lines up against God's people in battle is an enemy of God. Yes, that's true. And yet there is a distinction in how the warfare is to be conducted. So first, when Israel's army wages war against enemies outside the borders of the promised land, they are to first offer the people of that city terms of peace. And the details that are given in verse 11 here indicate that the terms offered were basically a vassal treaty. Under such terms, the people in that city would promise to really become subject to Israel and to serve Israel. And that might involve paying tribute to Israel, paying some kind of a tax to them. So if the city accepted those terms, war would not be necessary. There would be peace between Israel and those people. But if they rejected those terms, then the Israelites were instructed to besiege the city, to put all the adult males to the sword, and to take everything else as plunder. Now, I think that this is very significant, and really it's a picture of what's taking place as the church carries out its mission in the world today. What are we doing when we proclaim the gospel except offering sinners terms of peace? We're calling them to repent, to turn to Christ in faith, to submit to his lordship. And when people accept that offer, war is not necessary. They find peace with God. The judgment that was hanging over them is removed. But when they reject that offer of peace, well, then they remain under God's judgment. So in other words, this part of the passage points to the fact that while the kingdom of God has come, it is being manifested in this present age as a kingdom of grace right now. It's a kingdom of grace. At Christ's return, his kingdom will be manifested in a different way. It's the same kingdom, but it will be manifested as the kingdom of glory. And final justice will be established throughout the earth on that day, which means final judgment will be rendered upon all of his enemies. But until that day arrives, God isn't wiping out his enemies. What he is doing instead is he is extending them the offer of peace. Now, the peace is on his terms, not theirs. It's on the gospel's terms. But he's offering peace through the proclamation of the gospel. And so the church is Christ's embassy of peace to the world. And the church will continue to have that function all the way up until the day of Christ's return. While the Israelite army was commanded to offer those terms of peace to cities that were far away, cities that were outside of Canaan, they were not to do this with the cities within Canaan. Everything in those cities, including all the people who lived in them, were to be devoted to destruction. And this is sometimes referred to as harem warfare. Harem, not like a king's harem, as many wives. It's the Hebrew word that means devote to destruction. And the reason why God commanded Israel to do this was because he was establishing Israel as a very unique geopolitical entity, unlike any other that has ever existed. He was establishing Israel as a theocratic nation state in the promised land. And when God did that, when he set Israel up as his holy nation, what he was doing is he was causing his kingdom to descend to earth in typological form. And because of that, the ethical sanctions of God's heavenly kingdom were carried out in Israel in a manner that transcended the administration of justice in any other nation. And that helps us to understand, you know, the severity of some of Israel's laws. It helps us to understand why so many crimes were punishable by death in Old Testament Israel under the Sinai covenant. In a shadowy sense, the Sinai covenant caused God's future kingdom and its ethical principles to be drawn into the present age. And that means Old Testament holy war was a matter of realized eschatology. That is, it was a foreshadowing of the judgment that will one day fall upon everyone who has no share in the redemption purchased by Christ. Meredith Klein, once again, puts it this way. The identification of God's kingdom with the earthly kingdom of Israel brought an Old Testament anticipation of the final judgment, which is to overtake those who remain outside the redemptive kingdom of Christ. So, as Israel is preparing to take possession of the promised land, anyone inside the borders of that land who does not belong to the Lord is to be wiped out. Because, of course, in God's kingdom, in heaven, there will be no unbelievers. There will be no wicked people in that kingdom. They will be entirely shut out of it. Now, why did God command his people to conduct holy war or harem warfare? Well, there's two basic reasons. And the first reason is actually not explicitly stated here. I think it's implied a little bit, but it is explicitly stated earlier in the book. And that first reason is that the Canaanites deserved judgment. They were wicked. They were evil. As the Lord said back in chapter 9, it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out before you. So Israel was the instrument of God's judgment against these wicked nations. And we've already talked about how, you know, they did terrible things. They even engaged in child sacrifice. So their destruction was a typological picture of the destruction that awaits all the ungodly on the last day. Now, there's a second reason why the inhabitants of the land were to be devoted to destruction. And that's the reason that is explicitly stated here in Deuteronomy 20. And that is that if the Canaanites, if any of them, are allowed to remain in the land, then they will entice Israel into the worship of false gods. Now we might wonder, you know, why would the Israelites have been so tempted by idolatry? Well, we have to understand that there was something very unique about Israel's religion. Really, there were two things that made Israelite religion unique among the religions of the ancient world. The first was its monotheism, that they only believed that there is one God. And that their God is the one God, the creator, the sustainer, the king over all things. And then the second unique feature is that they prohibited the use of graven images to represent divine beings. All other religions, or just about all other religions, had both of those features. They were not monotheistic, and they did use graven images. And that made it all the easier for the Israelites to be drawn into those religions. You think of it this way. It's always alluring to conform. It's always alluring. It's always easier to conform and to be like everyone else. It's always harder to go against the flow. And yet the Lord insisted that his people worship him alone. And he wanted to make sure that they were not unnecessarily exposing themselves to temptation. And so he required them to cleanse the land of all idol worshippers. They were not to let the popularity and the seemingly pragmatic benefits of idolatry be a snare to them. They were not even to allow any Canaanites to remain in the land, lest they be a snare to them. Now, on this point, you know, we certainly do see that we live in a different redemptive historical context today. Unlike Old Testament Israel, the church does not exist as an entity that is culturally separate from the rest of the world. God explicitly commands us to live among the nations of the world, to be salt and light in the world. And so we share a common culture with unbelievers. And yet, we are still called to be religiously distinct from the people of the world. We share a common culture, but we're called to be religiously distinct. And so the same basic principle that is being communicated to the Israelites in this chapter is also being communicated to us. And the Apostle Paul reminds us of this in his letter to the Ephesians when he says, "Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them." So both of those principles are kind of encapsulated in that imperative there. If we're functioning as light, that means we're going to be out in the world. We are going to be exposing the works of darkness, but we're not going to be participating in them ourselves. And of course, that calls for wisdom. We need to ask the Lord for wisdom and discernment. We do need to be on guard against the many ways in which the unbelieving world would seek to press us into its mold and cause us to embrace its way of thinking. Well, the chapter then concludes with a paragraph in which the Lord forbids his people from destroying all the trees around a city that they're besieging. This is kind of an interesting, you know, addendum here, this final paragraph. You might think, how exactly does this relate to the overall themes here? I think it does relate, and I'll get to that in just a second. But first of all, you know, this military tactic of just cutting everything down, laying waste to the land, was actually a common tactic in that world. The Egyptians did it. Other nations in the ancient Near East did it. And that was especially the case in siege warfare. When they're laying siege to a city, they just wipe out everything all around the city. And yet the Lord forbids his people from doing that. He calls his people to be discriminating and to only cut down what was necessary for building siege works. Moreover, they're not even allowed to use fruit trees for the siege works, because that's not their purpose. Their purpose is to give fruit, and so they're not to be used in that way. They could eat from those trees, but they weren't allowed to destroy them. You see, once again, what we see here is how Israel's way of waging war is restrained by the fact that the Lord is the one who gives them the victory. They don't have to pull out all the stops like other nations. They don't have to fight in a manner that brings catastrophic collateral damage to their community and their land. Well, they can fight with the hope that they will be able to enjoy the fruits of their victory. And I think that that's a principle that's extremely helpful to us as we continue to fight the fight of faith. The thing that keeps us going in the fight is the hope that is set before us. No matter how hard the battle gets, we know that the ultimate victory has already been won by Christ. And we know, we're confident, that we will one day fully enjoy the spoils of that victory. The Christian life is not just this constant warfare. There is an end in sight, and it's a glorious end. As we'll sing at the conclusion of the service, "Thy saints in all this glorious war shall conquer, though they die. They view the triumph from afar and seize it with their eye." Amen.